Marabu High School. Would they stand, please? Good. You may be seated. Thank you for coming. And we have students from Wisconsin Heights High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and by this court. And in this program, we invite students from across the state, students in public schools, private schools, homeschool students, and we ask them, will they come to an oral argument? If the invitation is accepted, we send them materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the case and or may not. They come, listen to an oral argument, and at the end of the argument, the students will meet with a justice assigned for that day and discuss the procedures the court uses to take cases, hear cases, decide cases. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues of the cases that we are hearing today. And everyone is invited to attend that session. You need not be a student of Baraboo High School or Wisconsin Heights High School to attend the session. In fact, you will be joined by other Baraboo High School students who were here on the first argument and by Madison Memorial High School students who will be here for the third oral argument. If anyone here would like a summary of the facts and issues in this case, if you'd raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. All right, we won't give you any summaries because you didn't request them. Let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Annette Siegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He is the justice with whom you will meet today. On his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our second case today, 13AP298CR, State versus Richard Harrison. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, is Assistant Attorney General Peter Rank. Counsel, you may proceed. You have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, and the Assistant State Public Defender has 30 minutes between your original presentation and rebuttal. Counsel?
May it please the Court. I am Peter Rank, representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. Court's opinion should overrule State versus Austin. Court should reverse the Court of Appeals in this case and hold the common law forfeiture rule applies to objections to a judge's authority under Section 971.20. In this case, Mr. Harrison forfeited his objection under 971.20 by proceeding with judge counsel as the trial judge. Harrison participated in the arraignment, preliminary contested matters, the trial, and sentencing without objection under 971.20.
Counsel, weren't there four separate occasions during the proceedings that Mr. Harrison objected to judge counsel's continued participation?
There were two separate occasions during the trial portion of this proceeding in which Mr. Harrison indicated that he requested recusal of judge counsel.
Well, first we had the timely motion for judicial substitution, right?
Correct.
And that, according to my recollection of the record, that was granted.
That was granted.
And then another judge, Judge Pfluger, was properly assigned. I assume, I couldn't find it in the record, but I assume The order was signed by the chief judge of the district. That's my memory from when I was a circuit court judge for 6 years.
Judge counsel granted that it was timely, and it was went to the chief judge. The chief judge then assigned Judge Flugar.
Okay. So then what authority? Then once it was assigned to Judge Flugar, the preliminary hearing occurred. Before Judge Flugar, a bindover occurred, and then for some reason, which I can't find in the record, it went back to Judge Counsel. And I wonder what authority Judge Counsel had to preside after the timely motion for substitution had been granted.
And I think in this case, you're pinpointing the error in this case, which is that under the statute, the authority clearly upon that timely substitution was not vested in Judge Counsel. It was vested in the Circuit Court of Clark County still. And in this case, we start with forfeiture because Mr. Harrison and the prosecutor and the judge themselves, both judges, didn't raise the issue. And so it wasn't brought before the trial judge that he did not have authority under Section 971.20.
Well, he certainly filed an affidavit of prejudice, which is way more than just the substitution under the statutes to which he had a right, and the judge blew that off, right? Said the facts in the affidavit are they're not truthful. Or was that post-conviction motion, I think.
No, that was during the trial. That was about a month after the preliminary pretrial.
So how about that?
In that case, the attorney framed the motion as a motion for recusal to disqualify the judge for a conflict of interest. The judge appropriately, I think, interpreted that motion for recusal, and he used his discretion and under the law appropriately denied that motion for recusal because he was not disqualified because in his determination he did not have a conflict of interest, in part because the affidavit in his mind was fabricated.
Well, I guess you responded to my question by saying that I have pinpointed one of the problem areas here. Appreciate that. But I have not heard a response, and that is, once the timely motion for judicial substitution is filed, and once it is granted by the chief judge of the district, and a new judge is assigned to the case, what authority did Judge Counsel have to act in the proceedings? Question. What authority?
The statute divests him of authority.
Okay, so
the
answer
personally.
The answer is he had no authority once the substitution occurred.
Correct. Okay. Under the statute.
Well, under the statute.
Under the statute.
In any other way did he have authority?
The circuit court obviously is vested with authority and subject matter jurisdiction. The circuit court obviously, Judge Counsel.
Are you using circuit court and Judge Counsel synonymously?
I am not.
I see. And so my question, you seem to qualify your response. At least that was what I took from it. When you tagged on to the end, under the statute, which would lead a reasonable listener to believe, well, perhaps you have a different basis for Judge Counsel's authority to act once the substitution has occurred. And I don't think you have any, but if you do, I'm very interested in hearing.
And I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you explain what happened here? What was the procedure here? Judge Flugar is assigned the case. He conducts the preliminary examination. How did he disappear?
As occurs in the criminal proceedings, he was assigned the preliminary examination. Upon bindover, an originally assigned judge for trial was assigned. In this case, it was Judge Counsel, The record doesn't indicate why Judge Counsel was assigned as the trial judge. The record obviously doesn't indicate that it was presented as an issue that this substitution had occurred, or this motion for substitution had occurred previously. When Judge Flugar bound him over for trial to the Clark County courts, a new original judge or original trial judge was assigned.
Was there actually an order from the chief judge assigning this particular judge counsel?
Not in the record.
The other thing the statute does provide is for consent of everybody. Is there anything that indicates there was consent here?
There is not a formal application filed with the court, as the statute would require for authority to vest back in to judge counsel.
Counsel, you want us to overturn a case or two. Tell us why is it Austin and Clark that you're talking about of the two cases?
The case we are asking the court to overrule is State v. Austin. State v. Clark did not address this particular issue of forfeiture of the objection. State v. Austin should be overruled because it's inconsistent with other court rulings on the forfeiture of peremptory judicial substitution objections.
Let me just, by way of clarification, my recollection is the holding here in State versus Austin is right on point. It's on all fours, and so it's not really readily distinguishable. The holding is a substituted judge may not return to a case unless the required procedure is followed, and that judicial substitution is not subject to an implied waiver. So you need to get rid of that case, not just distinguish it. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So tell me why you want to, how we can definitely do that.
Well, it is inconsistent with other case law dealing with this peremptory judicial substitution objections. It's also inconsistent with this court's subsequent holding that circuit court competency, objection to the circuit court competency, which is a broader authority or broader power, can generally be forfeited or waived, as the terminology was used in that case. And lastly, the ruling in State v. Austin is inconsistent with the general principles of the common law forfeiture rule. The State v. Austin case points out three significant issues that it sees with allowing forfeiture in this type of for this type of objection, and those are directly contrary to the pillars of the common law forfeiture rule and why that rule exists.
Does the specific statutory procedure addressing the issue of consent have any implications to what you assert is the general rule that it is forfeited?
This court has indicated that direct statutory language indicating that a waiver has to be knowingly and intelligently given can affect that. But in this case, the statutory language is not specific in that regard. If we read the statute and the subsection 11, which indicates that the return of action to a substituted judge, the agreement needs to be signed either by the defendant or the defendant's attorney. The defendant doesn't need to know that the right is necessarily knowingly, intelligently waived. There's no indication that you need a on-the-record colloquy that he knows of the right, much less has intelligently waived it, to consent to return to the substituted judge. And the history of this section, this return to action section, is indicates it's there for just judicial efficiency. It's there to allow both courts and the parties to manage calendars to allow for a case to proceed efficiently. Now, the inconsistency with this court's ruling in McCrute, I think, is what really presents the strongest argument to overrule State v. Austin, and that is that this broader authority to act, or this broader power of the circuit court's competency, can be forfeited. Objections under that to that power can be forfeited, and this is a much narrower power that we're talking about. This is the judge's, one judge's, judge counsel's authority to act in this case.
Which was non-existent after the time of the motion for substitution. It occurs to me, counsel, that we are dealing in this case with legal issues rich with statutory directives, which we don't always have. And here it seems to me that the statutes prescribe the right and a method and a procedure for one who is charged with a criminal conduct to, without giving a reason, to substitute the judge who has been assigned. We call it substitution as of right. And then the statutes prescribe a method by which the matter may be reassigned to the judge who has been substituted. And now it seems to me that through a forfeiture argument, the state seems to be giving unilateral power to the defendant to confer competency on a particular judge after that judge has lost competency to proceed. And I don't understand how that theory squares with the statute, with the very specific, very on-point statutory procedures that we have here.
I will start with the DA also forfeited his objection under 971.20.
The DA has nothing to say about the exercise of substitution of judge as of right at the beginning.
Correct. But under the subsection 11, which you're talking about, DA has to sign off, as do both judges.
And the defendant, yeah.
And the defendant through the defendant's counsel. But so I think that there is not a unilateral right to confer through forfeiture, because the DA has the right to object. That's what the subsection is there for, to ensure efficiency for everybody.
Well, he has the unilateral right to proceed with the substitution by not participating in the procedure to reassign, to reconfer competency. He doesn't have to sign the paper.
The DA?
No, the defendant.
The defendant. That's correct. He doesn't. And moving back.
I think that our waiver, let me say our forfeiture jurisprudence is a little flexible. Some might even say loose. And that it boils down to, well, regardless of whether it's forfeited, the court can proceed however it wants, because it is a matter of judicial, generally speaking. I'm not sure here. You know, we've got this statute that has specific provisions on consent. But generally speaking, forfeiture is deemed to be a matter of judicial administration. And so in a particular case, if the court wants to proceed even though on the issues, even though it's been forfeited, and address the issues, you can. But then you don't have to if you don't want to. I mean, that's, I think, I look at, you were referring to this in a little more reverent terms, perhaps. But when I look at the village of Mickroot, at the end of that, there's a discussion. Really, I'm just paraphrasing that discussion, I think. So even if you're right, if the court wants to take it up and address this issue, it can. Isn't that correct?
That's my understanding of the law, and I think that would then go to whether or not an error occurred here and whether it was harmless error.
Well, whether
harmless error applies.
You concede there is an error, don't you?
I, as we must, the judge had been properly substituted. He was substituted for the preliminary examination, and as Justice Gableman pointed out, his authority to act was never revested in him through the statutory subsection. It goes to whether that the harmless error analysis should apply in this case, and the state contends that it should apply, as harmless error analysis applies to peremptory jury strike errors, as it applies to all but structural errors that have been identified in a limited number of.
Let me just, for my own clarification, I did not, although it sounded like it, in my question, you concede error here, don't you? I didn't mean that as a leading question to say, oh, you should confess error. I meant that as my understanding of your argument. Is my understanding correct that you're confessing error here?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I just didn't want to make it think that I necessarily.
Yeah. And as we did in the
trying to say you have to or you don't have to. I just wanted to know your position.
I appreciate that.
Now, if it's error, you think it's harmless error.
Correct.
Is that right? And you, if I understand this, it would be harmless error, but not under Strickland.
But, excuse me?
Not under Strickland, under ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't know that there's a difference, but I think there might be.
Our contention is that the appropriate avenue for review of this forfeiture is through Strickland and the ineffective assistance of counsel.
No, but that's not the argument he makes, is it?
That's not the argument.
Of ineffective assistance of counsel?
The Court of Appeals did not address that issue because, as I'm sure my counterpart will tell you, in post-conviction, there was not a Mockner hearing addressing that issue.
Correct. It was just that there was error here.
Right.
And that the error was under the statute. An error that was not corrected as the statute requires it to be corrected. Therefore, a violation of the statute, and the statute is done because there was no authority.
Correct.
All right. Now, you, if I can just move you for a moment to another topic, your position in your conclusion on page 41 of your brief is the court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the judgment of conviction and sentence. When I read the brief of the defendant says at page 41 that the defendant says affirm the Court of Appeals decision, and remand the case to a new trial. Okay, so far that's pretty good. That's easy. But there's another sentence in the defendant's brief, and it says, if this court reverses the Court of Appeals decision, that's what you wanted to do, then Harrison requests that this court remand the case to the Court of Appeals to decide issues not yet decided by the Court of Appeals. So, what's your position on that? If you should prevail, do we have to send it to the Court of Appeals, as the defendant says?
You certainly don't have to, as Justice Bradley said. It would be something of discretion of this court. It was the issues, the post-conviction issues that were not addressed by the Court of Appeals were fully briefed in the Court of Appeals, and that is part of this record. However, it's not an issue that was briefed before this court, and not one that was petitioned, because the Court of Appeals did not address those issues.
That's right. So ordinarily, in fact, the order says we're not going to look at the Court of Appeals briefs. If you want something here, you got to brief it here, right?
Yep.
So what are the issues that are still left unresolved?
There are issues of judge counsel's decisions on the post-conviction motions. One issue being that he granted what he deemed as an alternative request of the defendant, and therefore, in his
gave him a new sentence.
He gave him a new sentence.
Right.
And
but I assume that the shackles question was an error. I mean, that is assumed error. Or, but isn't this defendant here in his jail suit?
Yes, he was.
Doesn't he have, isn't he handcuffed? And that's before the jury. Ordinarily, you don't do that with the jury.
Those are issues of ineffective assistance to counsel that were brought up at post-conviction that were not addressed by judge counsel because of his determination that.
But if it went back, he hasn't had an appellate review of those issues, has he?
Not. No. That's correct.
So there would be, have to be a. Does there have to be appellate review? Is he entitled as a matter of law to appellate review of those issues?
I believe they are appropriately brought before the Court of Appeals.
So if you win here, we have to send it back to the Court of Appeals to decide whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel?
It's not ineffective assistance of counsel before the Court of Appeals. It's whether Judge Counsel's determinations at his post-conviction determination was appropriate or was
I thought that you said that ineffective assistance of counsel claim was made at the circuit court and then brought to the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals didn't deal with that claim. Maybe I just misunderstood.
And maybe I was unclear. My understanding of the record is that the post-conviction motion and the amended post-conviction motion both brought ineffective assistance to counsel claims. Judge Counsel did not address those claims. Okay, he found that those were moot, did not hold a Mockner hearing, and ruled in the alternative that the resentencing should occur and that mootness is out.
So there really wouldn't be anything for the Court of Appeals to deal with anyway on that issue because there's no Mockner hearing, so there's no record to review.
Correct. And the Court of Appeals would be addressing whether or not it was an appropriate decision.
Gotcha. Okay.
It should have been a Mockner hearing.
Whether or not Judge Counsel's decision was appropriate, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just going back, I think, to why State v. Austin should be overruled, I think State v. Austin's reasoning for not allowing implicit waiver or forfeiture is directly contrary to the general underlying rationale for having the common law rule of forfeiture. The three areas that Austin cited, condoning carelessness, unfairly penalizing less informed defendants, and this new form of judge shopping, are directly contrary to the pillars of common law forfeiture of ensuring that issues are raised at the court so that we don't have to appeal them, but then also encouraging diligent preparation. And then finally, to avoid the risk of sandbagging these issues, of strategically not raising these issues, and then subsequently, when the time is right, if necessary, requesting a reversal and a new trial. And I guess on the harmless error analysis, if the court determines that harmless error does apply, in this case, I think we can achieve our burden easily as a state. And I see that my red light is on.
Just finish your sentence, and then you'll have time in rebuttal, please.
In this case, Mr. Harrison received a fair trial, was convicted by a jury, and sentenced by an impartial judge. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Representing Mr. Harrison is Katie R. York, Assistant State Public Defender. Ms. York, fine.
May it please the court. My name is Katie York, and I represent Mr. Richard Harrison in this case. This is a situation, a very unique factual situation, where Mr. Harrison filed a timely substitution request. The judge left the case, a new judge was assigned, and then judge counsel returned to the case. I noted that Justice Prosser asked kind of what happened, why he came back. It's not 100% clear from the record because we did not have a post-conviction hearing. However, if you look at statements that Judge Flugar made when he was presiding over two hearings, a scheduling conference and a preliminary hearing. He initially noted that it was surprising and shocking that he was assigned before the preliminary hearing. Usually with a substitution request, he's assigned post-arraignment. And then he noted that Mr. Harrison filed a substitution request against his preliminary hearing judge, which seems to suggest potentially the court believed that if the substitution request was filed before the preliminary hearing, that meant that judge counsel could come back after the preliminary hearing. That is not the case. State v. Smith is directly on point with that, but my guess is from the record that that's likely what happened. Also, Judge Blugar noted after the evidence of the preliminary hearing when he bound Mr. Harrison over for trial that he would no longer be involved in the case and would be scheduled with judge counsel. So I think the facts and the circumstances tend to show that it was an intentional act, that judge counsel came on the case, and likely it's because they were misinterpreting the law regarding substitution. This case is also unique because it can be resolved basically just by looking at the statute, 971.20, with regard to forfeiture. It explains exactly how a judge can return to the case. That's under sub 11, when both parties and both judges agree in writing. To allow forfeiture in this context would really rewrite the statute to say that if both judges and both parties agree in writing, the judge can return, or if the judge returns for whatever reason and no one says anything. It's not what the legislature explained. And Austin is good law, well established, and relied on 971.20 to come to the conclusion that forfeiture does not apply. With regard to harmless error, I think the same analysis can be done. You can look directly at the statute, look at sub 11 that says when a properly substituted judge leaves the case, they have no authority to act further in the case. Because the court has no, or the judge has no authority to act, harmless error does not apply. So really looking at the statute kind of resolves both of the issues that are before the court today. Now, looking at Austin not only addressed sub 11, but Austin also addressed several substantial problems that the court was concerned about if forfeiture were to apply in this conduct, in this situation. First, it discussed condoning carelessness. Really, if forfeiture were to apply in this context, then the courts and the attorneys wouldn't need to be paying attention to whether or not a substitution request had been filed and had been granted. Essentially, they don't need to do their due diligence because if no one says anything, then that claim could be forfeited. Again, Austin referred to harming less informed defendants. I think this case is a prime example of that scenario, where Mr. Harrison repeatedly made it known to the court and to the judges that he did not want judge counsel to preside over his case, and essentially everyone ignored him. He doesn't know exactly what to say. He doesn't know he's supposed to cite to 971.20. He doesn't know he's supposed to say substitution of judge, but he's pretty close. He said change of judge. He wrote his affidavit. He mentioned recusal. He made it known he didn't want judge counsel on the case. And just because the attorneys and the court weren't really listening or were operating under some sort of misunderstanding of the law doesn't mean that he should be forfeiting his right to have the court address this issue. Also, forfeiture in this context would really affect the appearance of a fair trial. When a defendant determines that he wants a different judge, he files the substitution request properly, and that judge comes back, despite protestations from the defendant, just the perception of unfairness is very, very strong, and allowing forfeiture would be dangerous in this context. Forum shopping goes both ways, really. The state, if the state preferred. Judge Counsel could sit there if no one, if the defendant doesn't say anything when the judge returns, and the state could be getting the judge that they prefer, even though there was a properly filed substitution request. So I think Austin very appropriately went through the statute and went through all the reasons why forfeiture shouldn't apply in this context.
Counsel, in the record, it shows that he was charged after this case with a subsequent case, 2010 CF-134, and in that case, he again made a substitution of counsel. Now, the case that's before us is just the 2010 CF-88. Is there anything else in the record that we ought to know about from the number 134 case that would bear in any way on this, except he's consistent in trying to substitute out judge counsel?
Correct. And I think in that case he filed the substitution request, it appears, after the preliminary hearing, so that may be the difference, but there's no indication that judge counsel refused to get off that case as well.
Okay, so that has really nothing to do with our
No.
case. Okay, thank you very much.
Would that second request have gone to the chief judge?
It would have followed the same procedural path that the original or the substitution request followed in this case.
Why wouldn't the chief judge have acted on the second request?
Which are you talking about? The separate, the
second charge.
Second charge, yeah. The other case?
Yeah.
Well, I believe he did act, and well, it's not clear because I don't have the transcripts from that case, but he filed the substitution around the time of the arraignment, so I'm guessing that judge counsel removed himself from that case, but I don't know. That's not in this record.
Oh, okay.
So there's no indication that the chief judge did not act on that one.
Well, did the chief judge get an opportunity to act on the defendant's pro se request during trial that he didn't want this judge?
Are you referring to the affidavit that he
yes.
filed?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I believe just judge counsel ruled on that.
Well, I mean, a substitution request goes to the trial court judge. The trial court judge
yeah.
either approves it or doesn't. Once it's approved, then it goes to the chief judge for assignment.
Correct.
So it's not that the chief judge sees every request for substitution, right?
Correct. I believe it's the approved request. And with the initial substitution request, it was approved and electronically signed by judge counsel. And then I believe went to the chief judge, and I'm not sure if that is judge counsel or if that's a different judge in that area. I don't know.
Judge Stork, I think. At least I'm looking at the record.
Okay. Also, when looking at forfeiture, the state cites to McRoot, but McRoot is very distinguishable from this situation because McRoot didn't involve a statute similar to 971.20 sub 11. In other words, it didn't have a statute explaining how the judge could regain competency. So for all those reasons, I think forfeiture should not apply in this context. State v. Austin should not be overruled. And even if State v. Austin was overruled, based on the facts of this case, I don't believe Mr. Harrison did forfeit his right because he made it known that he did not want judge counsel to preside over his case. I would also note that if forfeiture were to apply, we would ask that that rule be applied prospectively because in this situation, Mr. Harrison's trial attorney could not be considered ineffective because at the time Austin was good law and therefore not objecting did not forfeit the claim, so his performance could not be considered deficient. So Mr. Harrison would not be privy to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So therefore, we would ask if the court did rule in the state's favor on this issue, that that rule be applied prospectively.
I gather you think forfeiture doesn't apply and waiver does, but if it's waiver, it has to be done by the statute. Is that a good summary of what your position is?
Yes, exactly. Yes, all parties, both judges would have to agree in writing for Mr. Harrison to waive the claim. And the state did mention defense counsel being able to sign that agreement without the defendant knowing about it. I don't know that that's really a realistic way to look at it. I think that would implicate some very strong ethical problems if the attorney was to sign off without notifying the defendant about his right.
You didn't file a cross petition for review, did you?
No.
So you haven't raised in your... Did you file a response? I think you did, to the petition for review?
Yes.
Your view is that your client has to get a decision on case on issues not resolved by the Court of Appeals should you lose here?
Yes. I would ask that those issues be remanded back to the Court of Appeals to decide whether or not Mr. Harrison would get a Mockner hearing. And as always, we would ask that any future hearings not be before Judge Counsel.
What are you relying on to get a remand?
Because the Court of Appeals did not make a decision on the merits of those issues. Those issues aren't before this court, so I believe that the Court of Appeals still would have the opportunity to decide the merits of those issues.
So you want us to send it back if we should decide your client should get a new trial?
No.
To send it back now to the Court of Appeals for them to decide whether
you should. I'm sorry. I must have been confusing.
No, my question was, if you lose here, as the state wishes, your position is you should go back to the Court of Appeals on these extra issues. That's my understanding of your position, right?
Yes.
And if you win, you don't want to go back.
We would like a new trial, yes.
Okay.
But that's your first alternative, right. But what's your basis for your second alternative, namely that go back for the new for a decision on issues not decided by the Court of Appeals. Now, if we would decide that the state is right, goes back on ineffective assistance of counsel or particular issues there that might be plain error, that could turn it around for a new trial, couldn't it, if it went back to the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But we wouldn't.
Well, they were raised as ineffective assistance of counsel, right. Mm-hmm. And really the issue in the Court of Appeals was whether or not we would get a Mockner hearing. I think maybe the handcuff issue, the court could conclude potentially that there's no way that he could lose on that issue after a Mockner hearing because prejudice would be presumed, and there could be no strategic reason for the trial attorney because the trial attorney did object after voir dire to Mr. Harrison being handcuffed in front of the jury. So clearly he didn't want Mr. Harrison to be handcuffed. So on that issue, potentially, but really the request in the Court of Appeals was for a Mockner hearing on all of those ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
Was there any record made as to why the judge was allowing the defendant to be handcuffed in front of the jury and to require him to wear jail garb in front of the jury?
No, there's nothing in the record concerning why. It's just clear from the record because every time Mr. Harrison is identified, he's identified in his orange jail uniform. As far as the handcuffs, no one mentioned anything about the handcuffs until after voir dire when the trial attorney objected. And then Judge Counsel asked the deputy in the courtroom whether or not Mr. Harrison needed to be handcuffed. He said he didn't, and then he was unhandcuffed. But there was no pretrial discussion about what would happen, whether he needed restraints, which is actually quite common. And I would imagine every trial I've read or participated in has a conversation about restraints and jail uniforms, but there was no such conversation in this case.
Was the judge's discussion with the bailiff on the record before the jury?
I don't believe the jury was in the room for that discussion.
So the jury saw him handcuffed, and then the next time they saw him, they didn't see him handcuffed.
Correct.
Still in the orange suit?
Still in the orange suit, yes. He was in the orange suit during the entire trial. And with regard to harmless error on the substitution issue, we would argue that harmless error does not apply in this context. This case involves the court's competency. The court lacked competency to proceed. Harmless error does not apply in cases of competency. And really, to apply harmless error here would nullify the substitution statute because it's essentially saying the judge does not have authority to act unless if the judge acts appropriately, which really there would be no substitution statute if that were to happen. I think you get to the same result if you choose to do a structural error analysis. Doing a structural error analysis, you look at whether or not it's a trial error or if it's structural. Trial errors can be pinpointed. They can be assessed. They are quantifiable. Structural errors implicate the framework. They are part of everything. They're inherently elusive to try to assess for a harmless error analysis. In this situation, really, the judge is a part of the framework. The judge is a part of everything. The judge is making decisions, setting the tone, and ultimately the judge sentenced Mr. Harrison. To say that it's anything other than something that affects the framework would be incorrect. If harmless error did apply in this situation, I think it's very clear that Mr. Harrison was harmed by Judge Counsel presiding over his case, and we've kind of touched on many of these issues. He was handcuffed in front of the jury. The judge didn't say anything. It is the court's duty to inquire about such restraints. The court did not do anything. The judge did not do anything when Mr. Harrison was wearing his jail uniform during trial. He also denied a plea agreement. Exactly what that plea agreement is and what happened is not on the record because that was something that we asked to address at the post-conviction hearing. But as you can see from the amended post-conviction motion, Mr. Harrison does allege that there was a plea agreement that he was willing to take. The judge denied that agreement off the record without Mr. Harrison being present, only in front of the attorneys. If we had a post-conviction hearing, we would attempt to recreate that record, but at this point, we don't really know exactly what happened. And then regarding sentencing, if Mr. Harrison did not have judge counsel, it's very likely he would have received a different sentence. He received a sentence of 13 years initial confinement and 7 years of extended supervision. When you look at the PSI, they recommended 5 years initial confinement and 6 years extended supervision. So this judge nearly tripled the initial confinement time when he sentenced Mr. Harrison. So to say that he would have received the same sentence had he had a different judge, it's just very unlikely. So even if harmless error was to apply in this context, I believe this is the very rare circumstance where you can show that Mr. Harrison was harmed by having judge counsel preside over his case.
When you say he refused the plea and it was off the record, that's really all you know about it? I mean, it was presented to him outside of the presence of the defendant, and he said, no, I won't hear a plea agreement, or do you know anything more about that?
What was alleged in the motion, and therefore what I know about it, is that Mr. Harrison says that he was willing to accept an agreement, and I believe it was to plead to the maybe all of the charges, and there would be a recommendation capped at 2 years initial confinement, 3 years extended supervision. The trial attorney confirmed that there was such an agreement, but wasn't specific about the time, and confirmed that there was a conversation with the judge and both attorneys off the record, and the judge denied that plea agreement. I don't know why.
Okay, thank you.
So ultimately, we are asking that Austin not be overruled, forfeiture not apply in this context, harmless error also not apply in this context, and that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision. If there are no further questions.
Are there any further questions? All right. Counsel, thank you. Mr. Rank, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. And I wanted to start with Justice Gableman and the authority conversation that we had at the beginning of my initial time. And while the statutory mandate is, as you made clear, pretty clear, that doesn't necessarily mean that forfeiture cannot apply. And I think that's the important holding that we pull from the McCrute case, which is that although statutory mandates may affect a court's competency, a party can forfeit their objection to competency. But moving on to some of the record.
I thought we already went over that. And in this case, I don't know if you're just speaking in general, and I don't disagree with you in general. And even if you're talking about this case, I don't disagree with you, but the statute prescribes a certain way by which one accused of criminal conduct may forfeit the previously invoked right to substitution, and that method was not followed, that statutory method was not followed here. So please, I stand to be corrected if anything I've said is wrong, but I don't get your point as anything new, unless I'm missing something.
And potentially here, his initial invocation of the substitution statute, is that the differentiator between this and the competency objections under the McCrute case?
So you mean because he substituted, or he filed the substitution motion, that distinguishes it perhaps from a general theory or a general principle that one accused of criminal conduct may forfeit other claims of competency? Okay, thank you. I understand.
Yeah, and just to clear up a few of these issues in the record, first, Mr. Harrison was represented by counsel throughout this entire criminal matter. So I know that there was a comment about a pro se motion or statement to recuse or to move to recuse judge counsel. Again, he was represented by counsel throughout this proceeding.
Counsel didn't want him to file that motion, did he?
Counsel did not want to file that motion. That's pretty clear from the letter.
Right. Did counsel sign the motion?
Counsel signed the letter that was interpreted as the motion, yes. Okay. And counsel filed the affidavit of Mr. Harrison. It's also not clear from the record why this case ultimately was reassigned to judge counsel as the trial judge. The transcript from the preliminary hearing and the bind over, Judge Blugar was fairly clear in saying that this is properly before the Clark County Court, and so arraignment should be scheduled through the Clark County Court. Now,
did he say specifically before Judge Counsel?
In the second sentence, he said you can schedule that with Judge Counsel. Whether or not I would suggest it's unclear whether he's replacing Judge Counsel for Clark County Court or specifically directing them to go to Judge Counsel. I think that's unclear from the record.
Whether Judge Counsel is just to be the scheduler rather than
the scheduler, or the court is to be the scheduler.
Yeah.
Second, what is clear from the record is that the arraignment, Mr. Harrison's counsel requested a peremptory judicial substitution of Judge Counsel in that 10 CF-134 case. He very specifically did not request or even bring up the idea of substitution in the 10 CF-88 case. Judge Counsel asked him what we're doing in that case, and he said, we're scheduling trial. I talked to my client about that, and he knows that we're just scheduling trial in that case. That's what's clear from the record. Again, the preliminary hearing, Mr. Harrison did go on the record and state that he hoped that there was going to be some motion for a change of judge based on conflict of interest or something else. And Judge Counsel rather appropriately said, it sounds like you really want to be talking to your attorney about this, and inquired if the attorney was able to talk with him and allowed the attorney and Mr. Harrison to discuss. And a month later, the attorney did file that motion for recusal with the affidavit. So the record is not clear why it happened. And finally, on harmless error, and I see that my light, red light is on.
Just finish your sentence, then.
Thank you. I believe that harmless error should apply here just as it did in the State v. Erickson case in addressing the peremptory jury strikes. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Rank. Thank you, Ms. York, for your arguments in this case, once again raising substitution and once again raising the issues of harmless error. And that concludes our hearing in 13AP 298 CR, State versus Harrison. The students should remain here if they can. Justice Crooks will be out shortly. And we will reconvene after a lunch recess at 1:30 for our third case today. We are in recess.